White Network presents The Heretics Hour with Carolyn Yeager.
Welcome and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. This is another live broadcast of The Heretics Hour on this Monday, June 18th. Yes, in a few days it will be the summer solstice in the Northern Hemisphere, an important milestone during the course of the year in our dim and illustrious past. Now we mention it, but it doesn't mean the same. This is the time of the year the sun is at its zenith in the sky. This year the solstice will occur on June 20th, just an hour before midnight, and that makes it about 48 hours from now. But that is universal time, so it's a little different for depending on where you are. But the summer solstice is also called midsummer, and celebrations and festivals have traditionally taken place at this time. It's a wonderful time of year, and I am glad to be alive tonight. I really just feel that, so I want to say it, and I'm glad to be able to bring you this program and to talk about white people and to talk to white people. Tonight I have a returning guest whose unusual name is Severus Niffleson. His blog is Niffleson's Mind at niffleson.blogspot.com. You will be able to participate in the program tonight by emailing questions to me at carolyn@carolynyeager.com. I'll check my email during our single top of the hour break. We will have a 5-minute break between hour one and hour two. Otherwise, we won't have any interruptions. And I will check my email probably a couple more times in the second hour, if I remember. So that is carolyn@carolynyeager.com. All right, let's get on with the program. Hello, Severus. It's so good to have you here.
Thank you for having me, Carolyn. It's a pleasure.
Well, I would like you to tell the listeners something about yourself, whatever you think is appropriate or that they should know, because I really don't have that much that I can tell them about you apart from your blog and that you've been on this program before. In fact, you and I did the very popular program about National National Socialism, Strasserism, and European Nationalism, something like that.
Yes, that's it.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Let's see if I can encapsulate in a very short manner some type of background, right? I was born and raised in Europe, primarily Spain. I have lived throughout South America, Central America, and the United States. So my background is particular because I have been able to come from Europe, but at the same time have a particular perspective on race relations based on my experience in countries that are primarily non-white, primarily mixed, right? Because most people, depending on the country, right? But the closer you get to the equator and the further you get into Central America, it's primarily what you would call Native American, right? Or mm-hmm. Native populations, and most of them mixed with white, primarily. Although, unlike what most people think, there are a lot of white people in South America and Central America, but they tend to be kind of populate the upper classes, basically. It's almost like they sustained a connection between class and race as it used to be in the old days of colonial South America and Central America. I have been somewhat active in my own way, I guess, in the white nationalist movement for like 18 years. I mean, I arrived in the United States to study in the university when I was around 17 years old. And I was already what you would call active, in the sense that I would write, I would participate in those days. And I'm not that old, but I'm saying, you know, 18 years ago, it's not like the internet was such a big thing, right? I mean, my type of activism was literally on the street with a sign type of thing, right? I mean, that's the type of activism that existed at the time. And I think it was healthy, right? Because you were forced to get out there. I did go through college. I got, you know, my degrees, graduate degrees, et cetera. But I've always continued to you know, define my participation in the cause of our people, because these things evolve. Usually when you're younger, your perspective is different. When you're younger, your thing is to go out in the street and scream or whatever, or try to figure out a way to, with your youthful energy, right, to do something from a very particular youthful perspective. You know, throughout the years, I've modified my objective. My current objective, and this is the reason I believe that a lot of times, at least from my perspective, I rather do it from a somewhat behind the scenes type of thing, is because my objective is to specifically address white nationalists, so-called white nationalists. My objective is not to communicate to those who are basically not already in agreement, because I've realized for many years that the problem that we've had in the United States and Europe, everywhere, as a white nationalist movement, is actually defining ourselves and constructing a legitimately logical path, right? I mean, it's been kind of chaotic, right? So I've always felt, what skill do I have? And this is something that every white nationalist should do. What skill do I have, and how can I utilize this skill for the betterment of my people without an ego about it? Just what can I do? And then let me do it. And let me do it, you know, with a particular objective, not just randomly, right? So my objective is to tell white nationalists, this is what I think we should think about. This is what I think we should organize. We should do. This is how we should organize, that type of thing. And that's really, really the objective of what I'm doing right now, is basically to communicate to our own people, to those who are already active, that we need to have a vanguardist type of leadership. That we should develop leadership now, and not necessarily be so concentrate so much on mass movements, which are necessary, but at this point, you need a leadership before you have the mass movement. So my objective is to target the leadership aspect of it.
Oh, that sounds great. That really sounds great, you know, right up my alley there. And I think we really need people like you. So, all right, let's go on to your blog. And, you know, you've got about 5 articles on this Nicholson's Mind now, and each one of them, I've read them from the time you started the blog, and it's they're just really good, well thought out, carefully considered and well written articles, which give people a lot of good ideas. So I do encourage people to go there. Nifelson is Nifelson. It's just nifelson.blogspot.com. And right now, your latest article is called "Hooked on Weakness." And you start out with the sentence, "American Indians lost their lands when they got hooked on the white man's goods." That's such a great opening sentence. So why don't you continue on with that? And because, you know, we're all steeped in this idea. Well, I'm not anymore, but we had been. Not so much me. I'm older. They didn't talk about that when I was in school. But you know, that all this business about what we did to the American Indians, that's all, it comes up all the time now. Oh, my God, you know, look what you did to the American Indians. So, all right, give us your version of what happened then.
Well, I mean, there's a couple of mainstream books that I can later send you the links, and we can put them, like, attach them to the show.
Good.
But I'm talking about mainstream basic books, right? The one that comes to mind right now is The Mayflower, which is a spectacular book. I think it's Brooke, the last name, but I'll just send it and we can just attach it to the show. But there's a couple of mainstream books, right? We're not talking about conspiracy theory type books, right? We're talking about mainstream books that describe the actual interaction between Europeans and natives. And I use that term lightly, purposefully. But the interaction between these two groups is not at all as it's portrayed in the popular mind, right? Because the popular mind has this idea that Europeans just arrived, with a sword in hand, start, you know, chopping heads off and burning villages type of thing. And it's the completely opposite from that. And there's plenty of evidence of this. The pilgrims would arrive and they would find natives and they would communicate with them. Hey, can we stay here? Can we trade, etc.? And really from the beginning, there's a process in which the natives realize that Europeans have a lot of fancy stuff that they think is pretty great, right? I mean, they see their cool clothing and their mirrors and cutlery, and all these things are very fascinating to them. And I'll go further into that later, because I'm not necessarily saying that this is a reflection necessarily of how primitive they are. They are primitive in comparison to us. But my point is that we have fallen into this a little bit ourselves.
Yeah.
And that's basically the point of the article, right? But primarily, these natives became enamored by these objects. And they became enamored by the idea that these people were very sophisticated militarily as well. They were very strong and they had a lot of technology. So they went through a process in which slowly they started to exchange with Europeans land, fishing rights, hunting rights, and a lot of other things. I mean, they basically slowly started handing over to Europeans a lot of things in what you would call trade, but the trade was really detrimental to the indigenous population, I mean, from their perspective, because here you have a guy, a chief, who's basically giving the Europeans an entire lake where they used to fish just for the sake of having maybe a sword in hand or et cetera. And, mm-hmm. and little by little, they basically give up their entire or most of their important possessions, meaning land, rivers, lakes, et cetera.
But wouldn't people say how did that maybe they didn't understand what they were doing and there weren't any – did they sign contracts and so on? I mean
– Well, of course. During those days, a lot of this exchange was a barter type of system, the classic system. I mean, it was this contractual element of European business, right, of European exchange, mm-hmm. Is not very common throughout the world. In other cultures, that doesn't exist. It's just a shake of the hand. I'll give you this, you give me that.
Okay, and so the Indians, being somewhat honorable, I guess, they knew that they had given it away, and so they realized, well, it's gone.
Yeah, but they took it. But the thing is, though, that in the moment they realized that they had taken it, and actually, if you read the chronicles and a lot of these books that I'm going to mention, they actually have, you know, contemporary documentation of basically when they realized that they lost this type of property, they decided that they changed their mind because remember, they can't survive mm-hmm. now because they don't have fishing grounds, they don't have anything, right? I mean, they basically sold themselves out. And also they put themselves in a very precarious situation because now they use Europeans to fight their enemies, their other Indian enemies. And they realize that at the end result is that they're in a really bad spot, right? Because now you have these people that defeat your enemies and now they take over that land. So now your competition is the Europeans, right? Not anymore this other tribe that you disliked for centuries. Now you have Europeans actually using these resources, etc. So in the moment they realize this and they start attacking, Europeans is the moment the Europeans start fearing these indigenous populations as savages, dangerous type of savages, not just naive savages. There's some of them, but actual dangerous savages that they will come at night and try to basically kill Europeans or basically wipe out European families that were moving into these territories that they had sold themselves or traded. So this created a lot of animosity, legitimate animosity between these two populations. And eventually the story ends up as it is today, right? I mean, because
well,
at the
Could you go a little bit into what you meant by the Indians wanted to use the European man to fight their own enemies, their own native enemies?
Yeah, this is very common. Actually, it occurred very famously between the Spanish conquistadors, right, and the indigenous population. There's a Spanish friar. His name was Bartolomé de las Casas. He was a writer. And actually, the oldest documentation of the exchange between indigenous populations and Europeans is actually his book, right? Because he actually goes into it. Now keep in mind, the experience of the pilgrims and the Spanish conquistadors are completely different.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. I'm always thinking about the pilgrims. when you talk about this and the Indians. You know, I don't think I forget about the further down. The same thing was happening.
It's completely different. Now let me be clear. The same dynamic occurred. It's just that in the Pilgrim, it's a lot more benign. The Spanish were a lot more aggressive when it comes to how they utilize their trading. In other words, the Pilgrims just exchanged their goods, but they didn't necessarily have, at least in my opinion, a strategy of displacement, right? The Spanish did not have any intention whatsoever to live in these lands, right? So their purpose was not necessarily to get land. Their purpose was to get resources. So the objective is completely different. They used the same strategy, though. They would arrive, and and De Las Casas actually speaks about this, that the local population Indians would say, look, there's these other tribe of Indians that are crazy. If you please kill them all for us, we'll give you whatever you want, that type of thing.
Okay.
So they would actually pit Europeans against other tribes that they disliked. The same example can you see with Magellan. Magellan actually died for this reason, because Magellan was actually used by indigenous populations and the Pacific to actually kill other Indians. He actually gets killed by an indigenous population in a beachhead by this other tribe that he decided to defend against these other tribes, right? So in other words, this is a very common theme at the time that Europeans would almost like adopt tribes like their pets. Oh, these are our Indians. So who's messing with you guys? Okay, these other guys. Okay, so if you give me this river, fishing rights in your river, I'll go kill them all, type of thing. So you do have this type of dynamic that is very odd, because you have indigenous populations desiring European goods and European technology and European culture, and at the same time realizing that because these people have this technology and culture, they are superior to you, and therefore you can utilize them to wipe out your enemies. So a lot of times when Europeans will go into a territory and start fighting Indians, it was usually at the behest of other Indians. That's actually the point.
That's interesting.
Yeah. And that's why I simplify. I mean, in an article, you have to sometimes simplify purposefully, because you can't. I mean, I would have to write a dissertation. But
exactly.
The basic point is that this occurred. There's no doubt that this occurred. The issue is whether or not afterwards, the expansion of the West, etc., if this was a factor anymore. I don't think it was. I think that there was a switch in the mindset of the European into a different century, in which the objective was to basically get land, and that's it. But the initial contacts were actually pretty amicable, and there's plenty of evidence of this, and I believe that the indigenous populations themselves kind of stabbed themselves by becoming obsessed with European goods and with European military might.
Mm-hmm.
And my point is basically that we are suffering from something similar to that.
All right. Well, continue with your point then.
So I basically call, you know, consumerism is a modern term, but I like applying it retroactively. So I think consumerism, what I just described is consumerism, right? You have a population that sees this other population that comes to their territory and says, look, I have all these great goods, all these things, and you become obsessed with them, right? You become obsessed with their comfort, with their beauty, with their the advancement of their technology, to the entertainment of it, the comfort, etc. And I think that in our case, it's really our own goods that are being used. In other words, we actually create these goods, but we have been duped by foreign entities, foreign populations that are merchants, right? Because Jews, that's what they are—they're merchants. So they usually traffic in our goods. It's not like they create their own goods and then traffic with them. They basically use our own goods and they just traffic with them. So basically, they have used our own goods. And they have basically turned it around and sold it to us. And they have turned white people into the most, ravaging consumerist people in the history of humanity. Right? I mean, we're obsessed with consuming. And of course, this affects other populations. But I'm only talking about white people, because it's really my only concern. And white people in particular have been hooked on this concept of consuming and of entertainment and of comfort.
I think entertainment is such an important one. Of course, convenience is too, but there's nothing wrong with us creating conveniences for ourselves. Okay, go ahead.
No, it depends how comfort is utilized, right? Convenience See, the thing is, convenience is it has a dark brother, right? Which is laziness and submission. Because a population that becomes comfortable can also become very weak and soft, right? Because the more comfortable you are, the more detached you are from reality, right? I mean, because electricity, which we like, I mean, I'm not. I hope that eventually I can clarify this. It's not that I'm saying that you have to go into a cave or something and start, brandishing swords and everything. My point is that you have to be aware of the dark side of technology. And the dark side of technology is that the more you depend on electricity and the more you depend on phones, the more you depend on computers, the more you depend on air conditioning, etc., the less aware you are of reality. Because these things seem to be real, but they're merely technological concoctions, right? They basically help us out. But without these things, we should be able to survive. And the reality is that most people wouldn't. I mean, if you cut off electricity, most people would just go nuts, right? Because they wouldn't be able to know what to do in life. And if you cut off their water, forget it, right? And these are very, if you think about it, these are very silly things that a couple hundred years ago, and I even dare say 100 years ago, there wasn't an issue. My great-grandparents didn't have an issue with electricity. They didn't have an issue that if you cut off their water, it would die. But most current populations would. So you have to be careful with comfort, that if you become too comfortable, then you cannot really engage reality because you're disconnected from it. And almost all your views of the world will become warped by this comfort. So comfort is okay, but you have to be aware of it, is my point. If you're aware of it, it's better than if you're unaware of it.
Yes. Well, you know, I always enjoyed living in kind of primitive conditions and not too, primitive if I were just, camping or something, or traveling, but I like real, when things get very simplified, you really can enjoy your life more than when you're dealing with all the stuff you have to take care of and keep going. So I think that I think that's not so hard for us, but we're not used to it, and we're constantly told. I mean, we're just constantly coddled in this way that, well, we couldn't possibly do without all these things, and we couldn't possibly. But how do you get people to go back a little bit from where they are?
But that's the thing. If we say entertainment and comfort, right? Because the point is that we have been sold our own goods back, right? Comfort, electricity, all these things, right? That they're good, but these things, we now consume them like they're food, right? We consume technology, we consume entertainment, and these things, we are basically in love with these things, just like the natives were. We're absolutely in love with these things to the point in which we are willing to give everything away. We're willing to give our inheritance away, which is basically our land, and our genes are the biggest inheritance. And the genes are the biggest inheritance we have, right? So we're willing to give everything away for the sake of not being bothered or losing some comfort, or getting bored, or somehow being disturbed, right? And that is really the point. The point is that by us coming out of our native self, right, which even our technology allowed us to have, only 100 years ago, most men were still connected to the world. I mean, literally connected to natural reality. But our generations are not. And therefore, to us, threatening us with any type of discomfort is easier to do and easier to manipulate us, right? Because we're basically trapped within the system, with this machine. And this, to me, is really the danger of consumerism. And this is the danger of modern capitalism. And I think these two elements, which is consumerism, this idea that we have to consume technology, is, in my opinion, the reason why we're in this bind, aside from other issues. And of course, who is selling us these goods? We can point clearly, well, we have a particular population who specifically sells us these things, because if you notice, most Jews themselves, a lot of times, don't even participate in this type of consumption, right? If you look at Orthodox, they don't even want to turn on the light on Saturday, right? They tend to advocate primitivism in a way for themselves. But they advocate Uber technology and hyper consumerism for everyone else, and we bought it. And because we bought it, and it's really our fault too, because we're buying it. I mean, we're participating of it. Then we
are. Well, so many people have just made this the meaning of life. I mean, this is what life is. You get as much stuff, and then you sit around with it or enjoy it or whatever, or you travel or you do this or that. But we have to put something in place of that, don't we? I mean, so there we go. We're back to that concern for our race and for our continuation as a race on this planet and so on. If this came first, then this we would give up this other stuff that if it got in the way of it, right?
Yes, I mean the thing is that this tendency is basically a perverted version of our natural tendency to desire the accumulation of things and to desire a position for ourselves and to desire the practicality of things, right? I mean, a car is practical, conceptually speaking. You get a car, you can get somewhere quicker, right?
Absolutely.
And email is great because you can send. I mean, so these things, conceptually speaking, are okay. The issue is not that. The issue is that if we are too enamored by it, then they turn against us. It's almost like this beast, right, that we feed, and he's okay at first, but then suddenly he starts demanding more and more and more until eventually he eats us up. So I believe the objective of my article was basically to point this out and then make a comparison, to point out the fact that we need a bit more of barbarism in our soul, basically. And I was addressing this in general. In other words, we need to maybe encourage in ourselves a little bit of this getting back to nature, kind of retracting a little bit from this. In other words, try to disconnect your TV, in other words, right? And if you're going to watch a TV, watch something that encourages this natural instinct instead of watching things that encourage passivity and encourage consumption. In other words, you can try to turn what's already there into something more active, more positive. But you have to do it conceptually. You have to do it with yourself. In other words, you have to analyze yourself and see, am I participating of this? Am I weak in this? Am I too soft? Especially men. And I'm not saying this because I think I'm he-man. I'm saying I have to analyze this myself. I look at myself every day and say, wait a minute.
Well, I know you do. You know, I unplugged, I got rid of TV so long ago. I can't tell you. It was like around 1982. And it's not that I've never seen TV in the meantime, but I didn't have it where I lived. I don't need TV. I can't stand TV. And so I have a hard time. I don't have a hard time, but I feel sad that so many people still think they have to have that TV. People who are in our movement and still think they need to watch the news just to see what that other side is saying and so on. I don't believe that, you know, because you can get it all on the internet. Of course, I spend an awful lot of time on the internet and I see some stuff I don't, but you have to see some of it. You know, I see it, but I don't spend a lot of time with it. I see all the blacks and I see all the mixed couples that they show and I read some of the stuff by Jews about, say, the Holocaust or something, but not even too much of it because I know what they're going to say. I mean, you know it all already. Why you need to keep checking and seeing what they're saying now? Because it's not going to change. And, what would you say to that?
Well, no, but it's true. It's true. I mean, the thing is, that's really what you said is correct. When you say entertainment is a big deal, entertainment is a huge deal because our modern society is obsessed with entertainment. Everything has to be entertaining somehow, and you have to be entertained constantly. And everything has to, it's an issue of how much entertainment, am I entertained enough? Almost everyone thinks, oh, tonight after work, I'm going to go entertain myself. There's an obsession with entertainment.
And isn't it also a distraction? A lot of
what
a lot of it is not even all that entertaining. I mean, it's not there's not much that's entertaining to me. Actually, I like to work. You know, I like to do the kind of work that I do. That makes me feel better because it's fulfilling to me and it makes me use my abilities and challenges me. And so I don't like to just sit and be entertained. I don't find hardly anything of interest that's in the form of entertainment. I don't even see movies or anything. I have no desire to. So I might seem like a real dull thing to younger people. I understand, you know, when I was younger, I wasn't like that, but you know, it's a habit of being distracted all the time.
Well, it's called maturity, right? I mean, let's be honest. The thing is, most people today at 40 years old, they're still immature. I mean, this is just the reality, right? Because there's a retarded maturity in our culture based on this entertainment culture. I mean, because children want to play with their toys. I mean, I used to play with my toys all the time. But we kept playing with our toys until like 40 or whatever, right? I mean, that's the point. I mean, that's what really is, because all this type of entertainment is basically a childlike escapism, right? I mean, we're basically children. We haven't really grown up. We want to keep playing. We want it to be a party eternally, right? A nonstop party.
Yeah, children are supposed to play. I mean, play. Exactly. It helps children to grow and learn and all this stuff. It's a part of that. But like you say, at a certain point, your play turns into something different that you're growing and learning from.
Yes. When I was a kid, my grandfather, I had a lot of toys, right? My grandpa had, and one day I arrived and there was no toy. Like, he basically banished my toys. And he said, "This is over. You're already too big to be playing with toys. What are you, some fruit? You have to stop playing. You're a man now," right? So, but that type of thing is hilarious, right? But this is what we have to do to our own people. We have to take away their toys. And it's done. No more toys for you. You're 35 years old.
How do we do that? I don't know.
Well, I mean, there's an element. I wrote an article that has to do with basically being a little rough with our communication. And a lot of this has to do with it. In other words, there has to be an element of bullying and shaming. And it can be light. In other words, it can be subconscious. You can basically communicate to people that if you're 35 years old and you're still playing with toys, then you're borderline subnormal, right? You have a problem. And this element of this expectation of masculinity and maturity should be a part of the social structure, right? Of the socialization, which used to occur before, right? I mean, men were expected certain things because the culture expected it from them, and women expected it from them. A woman today goes out with a man, and he's playing Super Mario Brothers, and he's 40 years old. And instead of the woman saying, "What, you're a freak or something? What the hell's wrong with you?" No, I'll accept it. And so, in other words, it's part of a cultural thing. And of course, we can't change it in a day. An article's not going to do that. But the purpose is to eventually create a culture within our movement, that at least within our movement, because remember, this is not an issue of trying to convert every single person. A lot of white nationalists
have a very
weird view of what our objective is. Our objective is not to convert every single person. If that's really our objective, we'll never win. Because no one can ever achieve this. No one can convert every single person, a white person on earth, to agree with us. That's not the point. The point is to at least have a leadership, a vanguard of leadership that is in the correct path. Because people tend to follow. So if you have a couple of good leadership, of good men and women that know what the hell they're saying, you're going to have people that follow. But if our own leadership is falling prey to this kind of stupid consumerism, then we have problems. So our objective is not really to convert everyone to this. It's to our own people say, "Hey, okay, you guys, you're agreeing? Okay, so race matters, et cetera. The 6 points that I mentioned that we'll discuss a little bit later. If we agree with all this, perfect. Now, stop playing with your toys. And be a man, right?" And that's really the point of the article, per se. I mean, through it, I go through a process of explaining why does this matter? Why should men stop playing with their toys when they should be adults? Because civilizations without adults die, right? Without these elemental aspects of a society, we will die. We cannot survive. So we cannot live in a society of children and of imbeciles, and most people around walking around are both children and imbeciles, right? So we have to change this.
You know, if we're talking about a core group of people who understand and know what's at stake, we have to shame them. Do you agree with that? I don't know any other way.
No, I agree 100%. That's what I meant. I wrote an article about shaming. You have to shame people. By almost a level, it's basically a type of psychological bullying, right? You basically have to mock them and ridicule them for their unworthy attitude as members of the cadre of leadership in our movement, right? Because let's be honest, we're not that big of a movement, so almost every single member of our movement has to be visualized as a leadership type of movement, right? Because there's not that many, so those guys that they're, they seek high and whatever, and they read, like, I don't know, they read two books They read two chapters of Mein Kampf and they already agree, you know.
Yeah, that's right. Two chapters, that's about it.
That's two chapters, I agree. You know, whatever. Those guys, well, you have to shame them into, that's it? That's all you read? Aren't you ashamed of yourself? That type of thing. Your gut falls to the ground. Aren't you ashamed of yourself? That type of thing. In other words, there has to be a process in which we shame others and we shame ourselves when we find ourselves lacking. We have to be self-critical. But my point is, we have to do an in-house cleaning. And this in-house cleaning has to involve being critical of ourselves and use this self-criticism to become better. Because if not, we will not win, period. So we have to do it. And we have to understand these basics, right? And consumerism is one of them. And also understanding the basic structure of what society is, which is the reason why I went through a process of how society basically is built, what sustains that society, what issues matter, what issues don't, etc. I mean, there has to be a process of education, but we are the ones that have to be educated, right? Our group.
Well, who would you say is doing the best job of this? I mean, leaving out yourself, which you would do anyway, but I'm going to say leaving out you. Looking over the horizon there, who is doing this the best? And maybe who's doing it the worst? I don't mind pointing things out on my program, naming names and so on.
Well, I think that there's, and I'm using this term just very lightly, but there are a couple of white nationalist movements, and I'm not going to directly mention them, but people usually know what I'm talking about, because I'm actually criticizing more the feel, right? That they have polished, it's almost like they created a bourgeois kind of armchair white nationalist movement, that they sit around with cocktails and they talk about Jews, right? That's the type of white nationalists, right? Now some of those, I mean, I appreciate some of them are legitimate intellectuals, right? We're talking about legitimate intellectuals, that, you know, they are sophisticated people and they do good things, right? But you also have this other kind of, armchair general type of white nationalists, that the only reason that they want to have cocktails and hors d'oeuvres and talk about, you know, Nazi Germany is because they're afraid of actually getting punched in the face, right? So they rather sit around and, you know, and talk about these things and hiding in a house than actually engaging in things that involve a little bit more more masculinity, right? So I would be critical of them, at least for that sense. Actually, those groups tend to usually be very light on the Jewish question. They tend to say, well, I mean, depends which kind. Some are good, some are bad, that type of, because they're too civilized. In other words, we need more barbarian white nationalists. And I'll clarify that in a second, because I know people are going to misconstrue what I'm saying. We need more barbarian when you compare it to them, but you also need a little bit more sophistication, because we need leaders, and we don't necessarily need the beer drinking, you know, chugging down a keg of beer type of white nationalists. We need leadership, but leadership has to be balanced. It can't be all cocktails, and it can't be all, you know, punching walls. So you have to have a balance. Good leadership has to be balanced.
I can tell you who I think had found the right balance in this, you know, and you're right. You know, some people need to be brought into more barbarianism, and others need to be brought into more sophistication. So you're right, because we need that right place, that good spot, where a real white man should be. I like that. That's good.
Yeah,
but I would say the National Socialist, the real National Socialist in Germany had that right. We're in the right. Yes. Did that just right. They did that right.
Yeah, I would say that almost every successful movement in Europe that was of that branch was actually very well balanced, because the Falange was balanced. It had the masculinity of street fighting, but it was also, but it also had intellectual cadres, and they had a lot of hierarchical organization. In other words, the street fighter understood that there was a guy who was the brain of the movement, and they respected each other. In other words, they understood their roles. There was no jealousy. Oh, where do you think you are? That type of thing. No, there was a good structure, and there were balanced. There were men. They were willing to take a bullet, but at the same time, they were sophisticated enough to strategize, right? And I would say in Italy, you have the same type of movements. In Romania, with Codriano, you got those guys, right? That they would go on the street with bats, but they were also sophisticated enough to understand strategy and to not just act out of like a beer hall brawl. They actually had a plan. And this is important, right? So we need to balance ourselves. And I don't mind losing a couple of the cocktail guys, and I don't mind losing a couple of the brain dead lunatics in our fringe, and to have a more balanced group of people that are willing to accept leadership in whichever skill they have, but they're willing to accept leadership and to go out there and to push a particular objective, right? And to have a plan and to shame those that do things that are very unhealthy for our cause. And I don't think that's a bad thing.
Okay. Well, I have a comment here from someone. It's not the second hour, but I would like to encourage people who want to write something and participate in the show to ask a very simple question or make a very simple, because I don't really have time to read a lot of more subtle thought and try to understand what it is while I'm talking to my guest. So I'm not sure what this is. It's a comment. It's too long. Well, I'll read it. Today we are weakening. It is true. We are staying indoors and not doing enough of our own labor. I think we are disgusted by the social environment filled with Negroes and various mixed people. Well, naturally we are. Adolf Hitler observed that Germans were becoming a pathetic lot thanks to malnutrition and sexual vice, yet how well they bounced back after only a short period of healthy nationalistic living. But he only had to rally ethnic Germans among ethnic Germans. Our challenges today are unusual. Here's the question. Is the encroachment of Arabs into Europe some centuries ago a useful parallel? Did you get that? A parallel to what?
I don't know. I think they might be saying a parallel to today because you have an incursion of Arabs today.
Okay.
But yeah, but I mean, I don't know. The thing is,
oh yeah,
because
you said some centuries ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean,
I guess when the Islamic, battles against Europeans. Yes.
Yeah, but the difference is that those men and the men today are not the same. I mean, let's just be honest, right? We're not talking about the same men. Mm-hmm. We're talking about men that used to ride horses all day. You know, you could die from a bite or something. You know, you get cut in the leg and you could die, right? So we're talking about the complete different world. And contextually speaking, these men were eugenics used to work before, and there's no eugenics now. And actually, I don't know if a lot of people gave me some feedback on the article based on this comment of mine about eugenics, because I mentioned the Spartans, how the Spartans used to kill the
yes.
If you're a weak child, they just throw you out, right? And I make a comment that some people responded to it when I said that a lot of us should be the ones that have been thrown out right when we're born. Because what I'm trying to say basically is that is that we cannot compare ourselves to those men, but we can aspire to be. Of course, if you ask the men before, they would have said the same thing, right? If you ask Adolf Hitler, he would say, we're not the men that our ancestors were. And this is a healthy thing, because we should see ourselves that way. We shouldn't see ourselves like a lot of modern people see themselves, which is we are better than the past because our past ancestors were a bunch of idiots or primitive, whatever. No, no, no.
They think that we're always making progress, and because we have a different kind of technology, more advanced and so on, that somehow we're smarter and better than they were then. We certainly are weaker, actually.
No, we're weaker in every way because of those things. That's the irony of it, and that's why I wanted to point it out. And that's the reason I go into the issue of struggle, because the entire dynamic of a culture, when it's founded, when a country is founded, right, when a nation develops, it develops through struggle, through war, through strife, okay? And it doesn't matter how ideological you want to be. What makes a nation is, and that's why I mentioned, the sword and he who wields it, right? The sword and the guy who has it in his hand. And if you lose the sword and then you lose the man, you don't have anything. It's over. You don't have that nation. That nation is dead. Because you require what created that nation. And if you don't sustain that, you lose. It's how simple it is. And you're not going to keep the sword in your hand if you're playing video games. You're not going to keep the sword in your hand if you're too comfortable. You're going to keep the sword in your hand if you're alert, if you're aware of your surroundings, if you're constantly in a militant state of mind in which survival and advancement is your objective. And a lot of ancient cultures were like that. The Spartans, that's why I mentioned them. But the Romans were like that, right? The Athenians were like that in a lot of ways, etc. these cultures were constantly aware of danger surrounding them. We're in the same position. We just think we're not, but we are.
Yes. And not only that, people don't, they think, oh no, we don't want to do that. We don't want to have to be alert and always on guard and always just, you know, protecting our people and our group and our nation and so on. We want to just lay back and we want to solve all the problems. And that's why these promises of these stupid leaders like Woodrow Wilson and many others, you know, well, we're going to do this and then we'll have it everything perfect from then on, you know, and people believe that because that's what they want. They want all the danger to go away, and it never does it? And that's what Adolf Hitler said. You know, it's a constant struggle, and people don't want to hear that.
Because it doesn't matter if they want to hear it. The truth is that they still live it. But the thing is, they live under an illusion because the amount of violence that most people deal with in everyday life is a constant thing. The thing is that they live under the illusion. They don't have to face it, right? Because someone else is going to face it.
Oh, yeah. And I mean, even things that what comes to my mind is people with their belief in doctors in the medical profession. Oh, well, you know, I mean, there's the doctors and there's those hospitals there and they're all there. So, you know, we're all taken care of. They want to think that those things don't help them. You know, when the time many of them learn, millions and millions learn, when they're there and they're they're dying or whatever, that these people were not really able to help them. They should have been helping themselves long before.
No, exactly. And that's why I use the analogy of the weak ones, the ones in the cities that used to open the doors at night for the enemy troops, right? Thinking, oh, these guys will let me live and I'll be comfortable, so I'll just let them in. And they eventually end up dead, right? Because that's usually what always happens to traitors, right? And traitors are betraying themselves, right? Because the enemy's not going to trust the traitor. So you don't trust him. You shouldn't trust him yourself. But the enemy is not going to trust them either, right? So you're never going to be their pep. And the problem is that, and that's why I believe that encouraging a little bit more bellicose, a little bit more martial values in our people is very important. Because if we lose this contact with reality, if we allow ourselves to be disconnected, then it's very easy to basically dupe us into our own death. I mean, we'll put the noose around our own neck and we'll jump, right? And this is basically what we're doing. We're putting the noose around our neck, and we're saying, oh, how beautiful it looks. Let me change the shirt so it looks better. And that type of thing. And next thing you know, they're hanging, right? And this is what's happening to all of us. And the point is that again, if our own people, the people who are aware, the people in our movement, our leadership, is not aware of this and doesn't do everything every day to point this out, then we're in trouble. And let me clarify what I mean. Because what I notice is that a lot of white nationalists, and I see this every day, white nationalists are constantly going out and telling people things like, oh, but don't you realize that the white people are being genocided? Don't you realize the Jews on the media, et cetera? And all these subjects are important. And there should be a group of our leaders that actually dedicate to this energy, right? But the thing is, if you let go of touching on the other issues, in other words, there's primal issues that most white nationalists ignore. And the primal elements that basically tie everything together is the fact that life is struggle, that natural reality requires you to survive. The survival entails a lot of particular things that you have to do in life, that consuming for the sake of consumption is weakness, that weakness is a bad thing, is not a good thing, that being limp-wristed is not a good thing to celebrate, but a bad thing, etc. In other words, it's great to mention these other things, but if we still don't address a lot of the core elemental problems with white people, with our own people, then we are basically doomed. Because we'll just be spinning around, right? We'll just spend time spinning around about Jews on the media, the white race is screwed, and Jews on the media, the white race is screwed. But we're just circling around. But what about addressing this primal core element of our character that is flawed? And if we don't address them, and we don't address them openly, in other words, that other white people listen to it, and they don't go into the movement thinking that the only subject is these two things that are pretty obvious, right, to us. To a lot of people aren't. But there's other things involved in our struggle. And a lot of them has to do with a basic understanding of how societies function, a basic understanding of the fact that we are we are not separate from natural reality, that we are not separate from this planet, of this world, that we are in it, that we are not immune to reality. And we have to point this out constantly. It sounds crazy because it is a crazy thing to point out.
Well, no, I don't think it sounds crazy at all. But what I would say is that, where does culture fit into this? Because we talk all the time about culture. Now, I think people do need to know who the enemy is, but then they also need to see their own weaknesses. Like you're saying, I think this is very, very important. And, when we talk about survival, there are groups in white nationalists who focus a lot on culture. And say, well, I wanted to connect this with your speaking about our inner barbarian, and for males especially, of course, should be just for males. I don't know, but even women have to have a certain fierceness about them that if it's necessary, you know. So. Yes. This inner barbarian, how does that relate to those who want us to now I'm sounding like I'm really sticking the pin inside. I'm not anti-intellectual at all, but, you know, to get into so many of these writings, of past, writers, and culture and so on, how do we balance all that out? How would you see that? What would be, again, that perfect balance between the barbarian and the cultured man?
Well, the thing is, National Socialism in Germany had an answer for that. Because if you notice, the intellectual and the cultural elements of National Socialism were obsessed with martial values and with natural values, right? So they would constantly encourage through culture the strength, right, honor, you know, men with swords, that type of thing, right? I mean, the history of past battles, right? The honor of fighting for one's country, that type of thing. In other words, culture is, every culture is a reflection of the people, right? Except when that culture is controlled by a very few amount of people, right? Which is what happens now, that basically utilize our weaknesses and basically regurgitate them back at us with our fears and our desires, right? And that's what consumer society is. Consumer society is not a culture, because you cannot say that buying things is cultural. It isn't. It's just a characteristic, something you do, but it's not really cultural. Our culture has to reflect our values. Now, if you are into the cultural, and I know the types that you're talking about that specifically address culture, or it's a cultural thing. It is a cultural thing, but for you to create culture that actually can save us, that can actually work for us, that culture has to merge with the practical natural need of survival. So if you create culture that its only purpose is to entertain, or you create a culture that its only purpose is to make you think, it's not as sophisticated as a culture that makes you feel, and that these feelings are primal, that they go deep into your core of natural survival, of the desire to live, the desire to conquer, the desire to become better. And National Socialism did that, that the entire cultural machine was aimed at this purpose, which is unique, right? Unique in the modern world, because a lot of ancient cultures did this. I mean, Imperial Spain had a culture that was similar. Everything that was talked about was about a knight, about conquering some territory, about the warriors, etc. I mean, if you go to any European city right now, you'll see statues of men and horses with swords, right? I mean, this is...
Yeah,
this is,
well, but what about poetry and painting and...
Well, again, this reminds me of, and this is a weird reference, but Mao, right? Mao Zedong, right? He wrote a couple of books to specifically address art. Of course, he's a communist. But what I found always interesting about it is that he specifically said that for a revolutionary, remember, he's in the revolutionary band, art has to be revolutionary or it's not allowed, right? It's not acceptable because it has to be concentrated only on the political struggle. So if art is not political, it doesn't work. Well, I kind of agree in a way. In other words, if art and poetry and culture is not heroic, okay, then it's not worth a damn for European people.
Well, I think it also, but I think there's absolutely a place for art that is, that expresses the nature and the character and the quality and the beliefs and so on of the people. It doesn't have to be heroic in the sense of soldiering kind of heroic.
Oh, no.
And it doesn't have to be political either.
No, but that's not what I mean. Because the thing is, the thing is that the way I'm defining heroic is it's very actually open-ended. In other words, you can if you look at, for example, the paintings and the propaganda of National Socialism, of, for example, women, of the role of women, you've probably seen a lot of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
It is heroic. Because the female is portrayed as a heroic mother, right? The mother, the self-sacrificing mother, right? The strong
yes.
female who is strong but kind. And,
yes.
and I call that heroic.
But there's also a place for, a lot of animal paintings. There's also a place for what the culture has been, like the lifestyle of the people and so on, and all of that portrayed in different ways, just homey scenes and so on. It doesn't have to be, all like that. A lot of it was. And a lot
no,
of people
of course,
during
of
that
course.
Time painted that way because they thought that's what was desired. So they kind of, adapted to that.
well, but not only that. But the thing is that art and culture, because the question was more an issue of how do you address the cultural aspect of how white nationalists engage the world through culture, right? The thing is, at this moment in our history, we are in dire need of survival. So,
yes.
In other words, we have enough of the picturesque type of art or the expressionist art, which is basically a guy who, I feel today blue, I'll just paint something, right? We have enough of those guys, right? And we have enough of the man who's sad crying in his bedroom thinking of his girlfriend.
We have 1 minute. Let's close this off because we're going to go to our break in just 1 minute. I had a real good thought, but now I went and forgot it. But,
I mean, the point is, we have enough of those guys. But if the question is, what does the leadership, right, the vanguard of a movement need, is to pump into the culture art that reflects a particular objective. And that would be my point. My point is that one thing is what I believe generally an artist can do. And yes, if if I have a son and he wants to paint fairies, he's whatever. I mean, I'll question it personally, but I'll let him do it.
So it goes back to we have to balance off our survival needs with our culture, and we can't get carried away with culture, which is not helping us to survive. I would agree with that. Because survival is the most important thing. Everybody has to understand that survival is number one over everything else. So we'll talk more about how we're going to survive when we come back to this 5-minute musical interlude. See you then. Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen. This is Carolyn Yeager with the Heretics Hour, and my guest is Severus Niffelsen. And we're going to begin our second hour now, and I think that I'd like to just say that our culture, I didn't express myself all that well in the end of that last hour, but I think if our culture comes from who we are and is created by who we are, we can't go too wrong. I think that we import a lot, and also, even if it is white people doing it, if they're infected or if they're following other pathways than what is essentially the culture of the white folk, then that's not good either. So I think as long as it belongs to us and it's from us.
Yeah, I mean, the thing is, there's two views, and this is an interesting topic, right? Because it's an issue of what art is, right? What culture is. But the thing is, there's two views of culture that are pretty traditional, right? Which is, one is that culture has to reflect who the people, who they are, right? Who the people, who they were and what they are now. But there's also the view that culture should reflect what we wish to be, right? And the idea of the heroic culture is to express what we wish to be. And when you apply culture to politics, which is what I was discussing primarily, because one thing is culture as an expression of who we are, that expresses itself in dance, expresses itself in certain types of art, music, etc., which is fine, because this is part of culture. There's nothing wrong with this, right? Europeans, we've had this for thousands of years, and there's nothing wrong with it. And I don't expect dancing to become martial dancing or something like that, right? But what I'm saying is that when we have a particular objective, and our objective is to teach our people that when you are in dire need, certain values are required, and that these values should be sustained, culture must be utilized politically for the objective of communicating what we wish to be. And what we wish to be is a heroic, valiant people, and not a weak, submissive, consumer people. So that's basically what I'm saying. What I'm saying is that...
I think that's great. And I think you should absolutely stick with that. And I think you're right, and you put it very well. And we do need to understand this. You know, when I was a student and an art student, I mean, I had some pretty nice ideas about art, but then when I got into higher education, it was all Jewish-inspired abstraction and so on. I won't even go into all the different styles, but and it just destroyed my whole art, my whole development as an artist, really, and I had to pick it up again many years later, so I didn't have the kind of art career that I had thought I might have. But it, you know, it's just, it's so foreign. And I didn't know it was foreign. Of course, you know. So all this damage has been done to us and to our culture. And we have to undo this. We have to get rid of this. And I think most people are pretty sensitive to it, pretty aware of it. And they know what's crap and what's trash and what they don't have any, they can't respond to and don't like, and what they do like. So, and that goes for a lot. That counts for a lot, I mean.
Yeah, C.G. Jung, the great psychologist, right? I mean, he's the counterpart to Freud, right?
I got turned on to him at that same time in my life, and I read a whole lot of his writings. I was all carried away with the archetypes and so on.
Well, yeah, you should read The Red Book, which came recently, because it's basically his almost like his dream journal. But it's a spectacular book because it's in German. The book comes, you know, half of it is the original one with his actual notebook and his paintings. And then the other half is the translation, right? It's a spectacular book because in The Red Book, which is a very personal private book, he goes into the issue of art and dreams and the art of becoming, of integrating yourself, right? Because he had the idea that people are disjointed because while they're growing up, and this connects to what we're talking about, because his idea was that when you're growing up, you're basically disjointed from your core personality because you're socialized, right? So there's certain elements of socialization that are good, right? They tell you, don't do this, don't,
oh, you know, sure.
don't, don't steal this, don't beat that, right? But there's an element that is very dark in that socialization, which is there's an element of pushing the child to hide or to abscond from natural tendencies that the child may have, which a lot of them may actually include aggression, specifically in males, a certain level of competitiveness, etc. And Jung was obsessed with the idea that the only way to create an integrated human being was to basically merge these two realities. In other words, to realize that a lot of these instincts are not evil, but they're just part of who you are. But you have to integrate them in a way that they're there, but they're not subjugated to the point in which you have repressed tendencies to then act out these dark feelings, right? These desires. Freud saw the world completely different because as a Jew, he saw everything that the subconscious is something that has to remain subconscious, has to be suppressed and express some type of sexual problem. Jung didn't see the world that way. And he believed that the idea of becoming was the most important process of the human being. In other words, the acceptance of who you are. This relates to art. Because in the expression of culture, there's a desire of expressing the becoming, right? The integration of, for example, of your dreams, of what you wish, and literally your dreams, which is the subconscious, and what is real. And you have to, in the process of integrating it is what creates good art, right? That was the idea in culture. I believe that that's an interesting way of seeing the process of modern culture and the fact that most culture today has been taught that, oh, you have to just disconnect yourself from society and then express yourself in whichever way. And whichever way you express yourself is legitimate, that type of thing, right? And it's an individualistic, disconnected from culture type of expression. And that's what breeds all this kind of weird, disjointed type of art that doesn't make any sense because the person who's actually doing it is himself a disjointed psychotic person, right? So again, going back to culture, I think that the art of becoming, Nietzsche spoke about this, becoming, right? Becoming the Übermensch, right? The Superman, the overman is the process of overcoming, and art should reflect our desire of what we wish to be. And I think as white nationalists, what we want to be is a society that is heroic, beautiful, cultured, but strong and valiant. And these things have to be expressed somehow. So some of us will express it through writing. Some of us will express it through action. But all of us should express it outwardly and should aim at this is my point.
Well, I don't know if you're saying this. It kind of sounds like it, but I definitely think that people need to express themselves and say what they think and speak out. You know, I mean, even amongst a group of friends or whatever. I mean, I don't mean speak out on the street or whatever. I mean, just say what you really think because don't hold back too much because that leads you forward. For me, it's always been when I finally, so many times I didn't, you know, and then it just bothered me so much. But when I do yes. speak out, I hear what I say, and then it becomes real, and I either can judge it as wrong or right or yes or no or whatever. But if I don't ever say it, you know, I can't really move forward with something, well, you know, from there.
Yeah, and it's actually that is the process of integration. And the process of integration in the Jungian sense is mm-hmm. it's very traumatic for a lot of people because remember you're going through a process in which you repress a lot of these views that you have, you repress a lot of feelings about what you think is correct but socially is inappropriate, that type of thing. And you go through a process of self-suppression that is actually it actually will kill you, right? Because it'll eat you up from inside. And you should have you should develop the capacity for you to open up little by little and to be honest with yourself. Because if you can't be honest with yourself, you can't be honest with anybody. And this process will make you into an integrated person who is more productive to society. And ancient men used to be a lot better integrated because they were a lot more connected to their natural instincts, right? They didn't shun them necessarily. And today we're a repressed society. You know, this reminds me, if you don't mind, a quick diverging, really quick, is mm-hmm. I was having this conversation with someone in TeamSpeak. He asked me, oh, but I mean, we're not really achieving anything. What's the point? The type of nihilistic, kind of defeatist thing, which is very normal and it's natural. I'm not criticizing him. I'm just saying it happens a lot. What's the result? What do we do? And my answer has always been the same, which is I do not do this. And I think we've spoken privately about this. I don't do this for the exciting reward in the end, in which I'm going to be, a statue is going to be made out of me or something, and I'm going to be paraded down the streets, right? I mean, that's not the point. The point is that you're supposed to, in life, in general, you're supposed to fight. And you fight for the sake of fighting. You don't fight for the result. You want the result. You have an objective. But you don't fight for the excitement or for the reward of the victory. You fight because that's what you do, because you're supposed to fight. And if you fight with that mentality, relinquishing the fruits of your labor, right? I know it's kind of Eastern of me.
Well, it's kind of Bhagavad Gita, isn't it?
It is, exactly. I was going to say, that's really the dynamic, right? Arjuna, I don't want to fight. No, you have to fight because you're a warrior, and that's what you do. And you have to relinquish all this ignorant desire for you of the result, right? You relinquish the result, and you just fight.
Not everyone is a warrior, though. Would you say that among white nationalists, every male white nationalist should think of himself as a warrior? In that sense, that I have to fight because that's what I do. I'm a warrior.
Well, see, my answer is very particular because my answer would be yes, but I have a reason for this. My point is that not all white people should be warriors, but white nationals should be, because there's a difference. See, in other words, the cadre of leadership, it doesn't mean that they have to go out with swords. It means that they have to view their actions as warrior actions. Because remember, not all warriors have to be out with machine guns. Warriors write memos. Warriors do propaganda. Warriors do all kinds of swords, right? The point is that have to visualize themselves.
Well, I feel like a warrior. When I first started doing this, I had this, I wanted to have a website something about white warrior woman. Because, you know, I've always, I naturally am kind of warrior-like.
Well, but that's...
Of course, I know you're not talking about women.
I'm talking about men. But I'm talking about women, too. But men in particular, because, again, we're talking about our modern culture in which most men do not see themselves like that. Most men see themselves as merchants or worse, right? Was what the Gita would call Shudras, right? Like the lowest class. So right now, almost every single male in the white nationalist movement has to view their actions as warriors, and they have to fight, but they have to fight with some detachment, because if they don't, they will give in. You have to fight without necessarily considering, when I win, they'll write a book about me. No, because then that's the ego. You have to just fight. You just have to do it.
Yeah.
And you have to
Go ahead.
No, that's it. You have to do it.
Well, we have another comment here, a question. Actually, he sent two. The first one was just kind of lighthearted, I think. He said, can we still have our beer? He wanted to ask you if we can still have our beer. What's your answer to that?
That's a more complex answer, believe it or not, because... Let me do it as best possible. Check it out. Okay, so the short answer would be yes. The long answer would be no. Right? I mean, technically speaking, I don't have any power to enforce any of this. Right? So therefore, it's just my opinion. I'm saying this. It sounds silly that I'm saying that, but I actually have a point. The point is that you have a right as a white nationalist to do whatever the hell you want. The question is if you want to be good at what you do or you want to be bad at what you do. If you want to be bad at what you do, then yeah, go ahead, drink tequila and collect women, right? But if you want to be good at what you do, then relinquishing a lot of these consuming things, and beer includes anything that intoxicates you, right? That messes up your brain. It's not something that a warrior should do at all. Now, I understand what someone's going to call me and say, hey, but how about in Valhalla? Well, then drink in Valhalla, but don't drink now. How about that?
Okay.
Just wait till you're going Valhalla, and then you can drink all you want. But for now, if you can do your best to not do it as much as possible, it would be better for a cost, in my personal opinion.
Thank you for that answer. I like that answer. I agree with that very much. I think we just shouldn't. I think we're much too indulgent because it's always been that way, or other people are doing it, or it's just dumb. Anyway, here, then he says, it came back with the second email. He said, hasn't this weakness come from a pass-through from the middle class upon the working class. And then he says, in the 1960s, we fought the enemy in the street only to have our throats cut by the political and economical clout of the middle class. Boy, he doesn't like the middle class.
well, you know, see, the thing is, there's something to it because the middle class was the one targeted specifically for consuming these goods that we're describing, although the lower class was targeted to consume beer, which is a good example of what the reason I dislike it, because the lower class was advocated to go, oh, just go to the beer, to the bar, drink some, forget about the fact that they're screwing you over there at work and they're not paying you enough. Just go and have a couple of beers and relax, right? The middle class was not all consumed by cars, by things, because the more you buy, the more, the better the economy will be, etc. But all of them, blanket-wise, have been targeted for consumption. Now, of course, I understand the basic gist of what he's saying, because this is a class issue, because a lot of the lower-class whites, traditionally the working-class whites, I don't like the term low class, and I'll tell you why. Because in America, there's a confusion what low class means. Because in the United States, the middle class is really the lower class, right? And the lower class is not really a class at all because they don't work. They just consume. They just get fed by the government. And technically, in economics, that's not a class. That's just a slave, not even a slave class. It's like a leech class, right? That they just consume. They don't do anything. So that's not even a class, right? The working class, which was traditionally the middle class, the working class was had more masculine values, right? There were more, they'll punch you out if you disrespected their wife, that type of thing, right? and upper class males tended to be a little bit softer. But I think it's a blanket thing. It affects all classes. I think the upper class did have some of the softness historically, but they were also going to a duel and shoot you, right? And then you have the middle class that always had this issue, but I don't buy this lower class, middle class, upper class thing. I think it's a modern American illusion. I don't think it really existed per se. I mean, that's just my opinion, but that will take us into a whole different world.
All right. Well, so we've come now to, what white warrior males, white nationalists should not do. What should they do? I mean, where do you want to take it from here?
Well, that's even that will complicate it a little bit. But I think having general values would be better, because I think white nationalists deep down know what I'm talking about. I mean, I haven't spoken with anybody that tells me that they don't know what I'm talking about. Like, oh, what do you mean? No more toilets? I mean, they know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, of course.
They realize that what I mean is that they have to let go of their toys and they have to stop seeing the world as individualistic playground, and they have to not realize that they're part of a society, that reality does exist, the struggle is the natural part of life, and the survival is key to everything, and then therefore they have to, you know, if they're the correct age, I mean, if they're the right age, they have to exercise, they have to take care of their bodies, they have to eat better, they have to educate themselves constantly, they have to turn off the TV and read, right? Not comics, but actually read books. Think about issues, complex issues, write down what they think, think about strategy, develop ideas of what to do, organize them, put them into effect, analyze themselves. What is my skill level? Am I good at drawing? Am I good at writing? Am I good at organizing? Then apply those skills correctly to the cause and do it in a militant warrior way, in which you do it because you love doing it and you don't care about anything else. You do it like a warrior. But you have to, first of all, go through a process of self-analysis. You have to look at yourself, analyze, look at yourself in the mirror and say, wait, I've been far too long involved in this culture. Let me slowly, it doesn't have to be all at once, because Carolyn, this is like a drug, right? I mean, modern culture is a drug. So you can slowly disconnect from it, right? You can slowly say, you know what, I'm going to stop watching TV less. You know what, I'm going to stop listening to this a little bit less. You know what, I'm going to cut off music sometimes a little bit less, especially popular music, and I'm just going to use my time for other
more. There's also the cold turkey. Some people do better with cold turkey than little by little. I'm a little by little person. Myself.
Well, that's my point. My point is that's the softest way, right? If you want to go Spartan, just cut the whole thing. You know. So my point is that there has to be an introspection, right? You have to look at yourself and I've done it. You should do it. Everyone's done it. You go through, you look at yourself, you analyze yourself, and you say, you're never going to be perfect, but you say, what can I do better? And if you can find something you can do better, then you should work at being better. Because if we don't work at being better ourselves, how in the hell can we expect to lead our people into anything better if we don't do it for ourselves, right? So this is the initial point. The initial point.
Well, what keeps people from doing it? There's a lot who know this, and they probably tell themselves they're going to do it, they should do it, and then they don't do it. Or they go back, they quit something for a while, and then they go back. What is this? They don't have this sense strongly enough. They don't care enough. I'm so tired of hearing it said, well, things have to get worse before people will do anything. Well, my God, how much worse? When it gets that worse, we're done for, you know? So I don't believe that.
No. I think it literally is weakness, and we should call it weakness. So in other words, we should be ashamed of ourselves for our own weakness, and then we should point it out. We should say it is weakness. I am pathetic because I don't do this. I'm going to do it. In other words, the thing is, we live in a culture, especially the baby boomer generation that raised a lot of these Xers and Y generations, that they basically pardoned anything their children did. And they said, well, it's not your fault. I know you kind of suck, but it's okay. Exactly. You know, that type of culture, right?
They're even that in the schools. I mean, they had that all the way through school.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, so if anything, if the kid had trouble learning, it was the teacher's fault. It was never their fault.
Of course. Yeah. She doesn't know how to teach. You're deep down, you're probably brilliant. You're just getting Fs, that type of thing.
Yeah, but, lousy teacher.
Or you didn't run fast enough, but you know, it's unfair. You got second place. The point is, there has to be a tough love type of thing in which, and the thing is, in white nationalists, we have to do it to ourselves. In other words, we have to put peer pressure on ourselves constantly. And you have to do it on yourself. But we have to do it. It's our own house. Remember, I see white nationalists as part of my family. It doesn't matter what they are. It could be a Christian identity, a Woltonist. It doesn't matter what they are, what group, a clansman. And I see them as part of my family. I actually even visualize them as if they were inside like my house and they're part of my family. And because they're part of my family, then I do communicate with them when I think something. Hey, look, you know, I love you, but you're being a dirty person. That type of thing, right?
Like, well, I'd like to ask you, what would you say about white nationalist men who blame everything on feminism? I mean, I think these a lot. The ones who do that, the ones that I know and like, and they never do that. You hear them on these some of these forums, say like Stormfront or something. I'm not trying to put down Stormfront. No, they don't all do that there, but that's one place because there's so many posters there. They seem like men who have this, maybe have some weaknesses or they have some social dysfunctions or something. And then they want to blame everything on women. Now, I understand that the women are in kind of a bad way, but I don't really blame the women because I know what's been done to women and what women have been put through.
Of course.
So, of course.
not only that, but it actually underscores the fact that these men are in part of the expression, but the expression fits, right? They're the bitches of the women, right? Why? Because they're actually blaming women for their weakness, so therefore they're underscoring the fact that they are weak, right? Because if they were truly men, it wouldn't be that way, right? They would take command of the situation and address it in a positive way. We have to fix this. I don't think that women I think first of all, women are the targets, the initial targets of almost every attack of a foreign enemy, right? It's usually women. They should go, they steal your women, or they're trying to convince them, or they're trying to recruit them into it, right? So women are targets, right? And of course, mothers and fathers are to blame for a lot of what their children do. But I don't think it's a unique element of the mother. I think the father in particular is guilty of this. And I would say even more because the fathers are absent a lot of times. Mm-hmm. They're irresponsible with their children. They don't assume a masculine position of teaching. In other words, they let the woman push them around sometimes. And instead of being men about it, they just complain about it, which is itself what they would call a womanly thing, right? I mean, it's almost ironic because the things that they accuse women, they're actually doing it themselves, right? They're acting like women in the forums complaining when they should just take command of it, right? So I dislike that element of white nationalism because even if it were true, there's no point. This is something I was talking before. I mentioned in the show with Bill Fink, which is there's also an element of respect, right? If I go to the house of Ron McVan, right? He's a wilderness. I'm not going to disrespect them by pointing out the things that I disagree with, as an example, if I disagree with something, because it is disrespectful. At the end of the day, you have to be strategic in the way you communicate, because again, we're not a bunch of idiots running around forums. We have to be strategic. We have to know how to communicate. We have to learn how to communicate. This is another job that a lot of white nationalists have to do. Learn to communicate and learn to be respectful when we communicate, because people are more open to whatever you have to say when you're respectful and you listen to others. If you do not do this, they will not listen to you and you will never get your word across. It doesn't matter if it's true. You could be like the guy has the answer to everything, right? But if you do not respect others, you don't listen to others and take into consideration what they're saying, even if you disagree with it, you take into consideration, you say, well, I have this opinion. If you don't have a correct way of communicating, you will never get anywhere. And going to a forum and saying that women are to blame for everything is ridiculous. And at the same time, it's counterproductive anyway, because you want women in the movement as well, right?
Yes, absolutely. And then, you know, it's no wonder they're not there. But then you can't just cater to women either. I understand that. Okay. You know, I did want to mention that program that you are on Saturday night. And it was a Christigenia Saturday with Bill Fink and you and Mike Delaney. And I listened to it. I don't know what the title is now. But what is white nationalism or something? And you did.
The basics of white nationalism. Christianity.
Yeah. And Christianity. And you talked about the differences between in white nationalism between Christians and non-Christians or pagans or atheists or, you know, wokeness and so on. And these get very, very divisive and seemingly insoluble, but I think it's very important to try to make some bridges there. And so I would recommend that program to people. They can go to Christigenia or Christigenia, you might say it, .org, and you'll find it on the front there. You scroll down some.
Yeah, you can also find it on my site on the right. I put every show
that's
that
right.
Appear.
That's right.
You can click it there really easy, and it'll go straight to Christigenia.
That's right. That's right. When you go to Nifelson's Mind, just look for it there and click on it. It'll take you there. So, all right. Did you want to go over your basic points?
I can do that. And let me mention a point about what you said, because you're absolutely right. In our movement, we do have what seems to be a lot of so many divergent views of things, and this is not uncommon. Usually, movements when they're small and they're somewhat powerless, and I mean powerless in the true sense of the word, when it comes to state power or the power of force, which is really what power is. When you have enough people to impose force, you have a state, right? I mean, that's basically how it works. That's really what it is. I mean, if you have enough guys, they have enough guns, you suddenly have a state. But my point is that when movements are small, they tend to be fragmented and everyone has an idea. No, I know better than you. No, I know better than you. And usually when one guy starts doing things right and people acknowledge it, then they tend to fall into place, right? This is just human nature. In our case, in the case of the white nationalist movement, I've always been able to kind of travel through all these different movements in the sense that I can communicate to wilderness, social Darwinist, atheist, agnostic nationalist, creators, I should say creators, because that's how they pronounce it, and CI. And I've never had an issue that I can remember right now in my mind that I couldn't communicate to them. And I think that respect is the issue, because I can go to a wilderness, I'm not going to disrespect them, and CI the same thing. So I think there's a common ground. And yes, I did a basic list, and this is something that me and Bill were discussing originally. And we said, hey, we should discuss what the basics are. And before the show, I sat down and said, let me see if I can narrow it down to the basics. And I'll just, you know, people can listen to a show and actually go into them, but I'll just say them really quick because I think they're interesting, which is one, a basic understanding of racial reality, right? Of the biological reality, the races are different and they can be distinguished and recognized. And from that stems that equality is a farce, right? Because there is race, equality is a farce. Two, that the white race is unique. In other words, it deserves respect and protection because it is unique, it is special. It has done special things. Some people would say superior, some other groups would say it's just better, some people would say it doesn't matter if it's better, but it's unique. The point is, it is unique, right? Third, that most white nationalists should see history and civilization through a racial perspective. In other words, every time you analyze Egypt or analyze Mesopotamia or analyze Greece, you have to look at the racial angle. Okay, so what race was there? What group? What ethnic group? How was the relationship between slaves? Did non-whites arrive? That type of thing. Fourth, you have to see then that race mixing is wrong because genocide is wrong, right? Destroying a race that you admit is unique and that exists, you shouldn't kill it and destroy it, therefore race mixing is wrong. So if you're white nationalist, you shouldn't race mix. If you do, you're not really a white nationalist. Five, that the Jews are distinct, that they're racially distinct, you can identify them, that they're not part of our group, that they're not simply whites that happen to have kinky hair and happen to have hooked noses, that happen to have a different religion, but they legitimately are a separate religion, right? A separate ethnic group, a separate race, and therefore you have to see them as outsiders, and therefore they do not participate in your state. You have to exclude them. And, you know, they can have their own thing if they want, but the point is you exclude them from your own group. And the sixth would be patriarchy, which is the idea that our society has to be organized from a patriarchal mentality. It doesn't have to be patrilineal. It could be matrilineal. And I explain that if you want.
Well, explain that.
Yeah, because patriarchal just means that the structure, right, the power structure focuses on the male, usually the father, right? And the pater familias, right? Like in the Roman system. And the father is the center, the core of the family. And therefore, the father, that figure, expands, right? Until it becomes a king. Or you can call him a leader, a führer, whatever. The name doesn't matter because it still acts like a monarch. It's just people change the name, which is basically a father of a nation, right? And you can only have a father of a nation if the nations are the same people, right? That was the traditional view of fatherhood and the patriarchy, but it's male-centered. The male is the leadership, holds the leadership mm-hmm. role, okay? Now, patrilineal just means that you follow the hereditary line through the father. Matrilineal just means that you follow the hereditary line through the mother. Some cultures, and European cultures did have this, they would basically have, for example, like the mother's last name, for example, and they would guide, okay, so you're the son of this woman, and you're the son of this woman, or the daughter of this woman, and you would follow the line of the female to determine parentage, right? Whereas patrilineal, the male heir, it's followed through the male line. So the male follows the...
Why can't you use both? Because of things like inheritance and stuff? I mean, why can't you see yourself as a... through as both the male line and the female line.
Most Europeans are patriarchal and patrilineal, right? Because usually, especially the British and mm-hmm. the Germans, they just put the name of the father, right? That's it.
That's right. The mother's name has disappeared. That's right. But I know that in Spanish is different. Exactly. Everybody carries their mother's name.
Exactly. In Spain, we use both last names, right? And of course, eventually, when your son marries, then it'll be his wife's name of the child, right? But the point is, yes, you use both last names. In some cultures, it was only the mother's name. That's why I don't necessarily say patrilineal, matrilineal. That to me is somewhat, I mean... it's a different issue. Yeah, I don't care. But I do care about patriarchy because patriarchy sustains a society with the focus on the male values, the masculine values of survival, and the female values are there. But the male values are the center core of keeping the family together as male dominated. And I think that matters for a lot of reasons. And our societies have functioned that way, not only our societies, but animals, right? Most mammals function in a patriarchal system. And it functions for them. It should function for almost every mammal. It should work for us too. It has worked for a long time. And I don't think changing it would work at all. So those would be the six, right? I think that if you're a white nationalist and you technically don't agree with those things, then you're probably not a white nationalist. And most of these groups that you mentioned kind of agree with this. You know, the most Wotanists agree with this. Creators agree with this. The CIs agree with this, that type of thing. So, and generally speaking, we all have in common these basic ideas. And usually if you agree with these basic ideas, you're in my team. I mean, that's how I see it.
Well, what about Catholics? You keep mentioning CI, Christian Identity, who are totally on a racial belief system. You know,
yes.
You know, they're right on board with that, which is what's good. But what about, say, Catholics who are traditional Catholics? If they believe that race mixing is wrong, and if they believe that that they don't want any Jews around, that Jews are not us, and so on, then That would be all right. If the problem is in so much liberalism has gone into Christianity that it's just it's just become a.
But that's the thing. The thing is that the point of these values is that the issue is not how you label, and this is something that me and Bill we agree with absolutely, which is the issue of the label. And you could be a guy, because the thing is, in modern society, people label themselves however they want. People are crazy, right? So they say, "Oh, I'm a Buddhist," and they don't even know what that is, right? So today, what you label yourself, I usually tend to ignore. I mean, if I meet a Buddhist that says he's a white nationalist and he agrees with all this, then I'll just ignore the fact that he calls himself a Buddhist, right? The same thing if a Catholic, right? If a Catholic agrees with all this, you can make the argument that he's not a good Catholic, but I don't really care if he's a good Catholic. All I care if he's a good white nationalist. I don't really care if you're good at anything else except white nationalist. So to in my opinion, I don't really care too much. I mean, in my personal view is that I'm not really necessarily mystically inclined. I mean, personally, me. I'm not personally too interested. I've never really been too interested. I mean, I've studied a lot of it, but I'm not really necessarily too focused on it. I'm pretty open to the fact that you can have your own spirituality and I'm good to go, but I do care about these racial issues and about the survival of my people. I care about that. So if you agree with that with me, I don't care if you call yourself an Islamic Buddhist magician, as long as you're agree with these things, right? I mean, of course, I would question what kind of person you are if you're actually a white nationalist, say that you are those other things. But that's aside the point. The point is that you have to...
There you go. I think we are very hung up with labels. And if we had, like this list you've made, if we had a clear idea of what a white nationalist is or what a loyal white racialist is, then it wouldn't matter if you were... what your religion was or what you said it was, if you really followed this. That's what's important. If you really follow the white racial precepts that would be set down, it would be very clear.
Exactly.
So, but people seem to insist that the reason, well, I don't want to get into it because then it takes us into Christianity, into the Christianity debate.
But I understand that the basic gist of it is that.
But I wanted to say some things about patriarchy after you get done there.
Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Well, now, when it comes to patriarchy, you know, it depends on who I'm thinking. The other day I tried, after your program, Saturday night, I tried to think, you know, I was thinking about it because I have an immediate kind of bad response to the patriarchy word, but then I thought, what kind of country? What kind of leadership would you want? Would you want women? Would you want a female? Absolutely not. I mean, it would never work. That's, you know. So I knew it had to be men, and I know it has to be men, and I'm quite happy. Women are happy with that. Women want competent, but they also want kind men. You know, it depends on who's running the patriarchy, you see. And the fear comes in for a woman when you think that some, you know, it get into the hands of these callous types that, you know, blame everything on feminists and so on. And what we don't want is to become slaves. You know, we don't want to be seen as servants. We don't want to be, you know, and this is the fear that, and it all comes down then to people. Who's going to be in charge of this? What kind of men are going to be doing this? It has to be the best kind of men.
Well, this is a very important discussion, actually, because you're right. First of all, the term patriarchy, the reason that a lot of modern people have, I'm saying modern, I'm talking about 100 years, right? The reason that modern society has kind of frowns upon the term is because it was utilized, especially by Marxists, as a derisive term to basically describe all of Western culture, because Western culture historically was described as patriarchy. I don't know if you remember. I mean, I was not alive then, but I've studied this a lot. In the 60s and 70s, the women would scream, "Destroy the patriarchy! That was the patriarchy!" Right? The term patriarchy was specifically utilized, right, as a term of derision, which meant that women were enslaved with chains, cleaning floors on their knees, that type of thing, right?
Yeah, which never was happening.
Yeah,
was happening. It's just the fear of it.
Exactly.
And the stories that we hear from long ago when fathers could put their daughters to death if they didn't behave.
Yeah, of course. Those fathers could also put their sons to death, but I guess no one cares about the sons. but the point is that they could put anyone to death, because the truth is that the father, the pater familias, had absolute power over their family. Now, of course, this is somewhat of an illusion, conceptually speaking, because right now we live in a society that they have absolute power over us. They just don't call it patriarchy. They call it something else. But they still do the same things, right? I mean, if you want a woman to be enslaved, they'll enslave you. They'll just put a bikini on you and enslave you and make you feel that you're free. But they're still enslaving you. Now, the difference is if you look at past history, if you look at even monarchies, right, women had a lot of power. This is just a historical fact. All you have to do is go back and look at Rome. Look at the power that the women had for Caesar, right? I mean, the power in Augustus Caesar, right? The females were part of history, and they were very influential historically. And in general, women had a lot of power, even legal power, because if you look at Roman law, they actually
did.
Yes,
I know.
But the thing is, the authority of the father was non-negotiable. And women did not allow that for it to be negotiated, because females specifically saw that if you remove the authority of the father, the female would have no protection. And instead of having one male trying to dominate her, it'll be 20, right? Trying to control her and control her actions.
There you go.
So the father figure, the idea of a male in your family that would protect you, was considered to be a positive for women, and women had more freedom and more access to a lot of levels of power that today they don't. Because no one can tell me that in modern society women are powerful, because they are not powerful. They're basically utilized and abused for the sake of the consumer merchants that control this world.
Yeah, and they can't wait to do it, most of them, because they think that's just the best thing going.
Exactly.
And easy money or whatever. But then look at the leadership principle in the Third Reich. I mean, that's where the leader has the final say, and he has to be responsible for everything. You know, I go along with that, because
It's basically what monarchical government is, which means government by one. But the focus is the father, because remember that the Adolf Hitler was seen as the father.
Yes.
So the father loves his children and wants to protect the nation. And that view, that personal dynamic of the father and the family, of an extended family, is crucial of how we see patriarchy. And historically, it has been like that for thousands of years. And women were not being crucified upside down and thrown in wells like that. And of course, if you're going to use examples of bad things that happen, yes, of course, just like they happen today. Women get raped, murdered, cut in pieces every day, and no one's calling it patriarchy. They just call it crime, right? Crime is crime, and patriarchy is patriarchy. And I think that the women shouldn't confuse the two. The truth is that most women in this world grew up with a father. And yes, some had difficult relationship with their parents, with the fathers, and some had good relationship with the fathers. But I don't think they will blame the entire system of father, that we should abolish fathers from now on, because if not, female children will be abused by the father, right? They're going to be forced to do hard labor in the kitchen, that type of thing. I mean, it's a mentality that I think it's very sad, but unfortunately it is very common in modern society. But I don't think that patriarchy should scare the bejesus out of anyone.
Okay. Now back to the inner barbarian, and then there's the family man. Now we want men to be family men and not roaming single men so much. But how does a family man keep his inner barbarian, or I don't know, is there anything more you can say about all that to clarify?
First of all, the wife has to encourage the male to be a male, right? The wife, for her own petty desires, should not encourage the male to be a female. Because and this is not necessarily laying the blame on women. I'm just saying that women participate in this a little bit.
Women can do that. Yeah,
I
agree.
Exactly. And a woman should not feel proud that she can dominate her man to the point that he's a pathetic wimp, because then she shouldn't be proud of that guy at all. I mean, that's a horrible husband, right?
The man shouldn't allow
exactly.
that. I think, you know, women will kind of push, kind of like children do, I guess, to see, I don't know if they're even consciously, but it just happens, to see how far they can go.
Yeah.
And the man has to allow a certain amount and then stand up when it's too much and stand up absolutely firmly. Without any doubt. And a woman will be happy for that to happen.
Of course, because most women desire that in a man, right? That he's a man and he is a good protector for the family.
Yes.
So the inner barbarian, the man, when I say that, if you look at the ancient Celts, right, or the ancient Iberians, they didn't just go around when they were in battle, they would come home and then, you know, and serve me a steak or I'll kill you. I mean, this image is completely false, right? Because the home was a sanctuary, right? And mm-hmm. when the man arrived, the man was respected as the king of the house, and he was loved and respected, and he was happy to be in a place that is separate from the reality outside. And that separation, right? That sanctuary element is what modern society utilizes, and they have extended into consumerism. So that's why we hide in our homes and watch TV, because we're seeking that comfort of a family hearth, right? Of this feeling of being protected at home that is usually only found in a family, where the family structure and everyone's role is really well cleared out, and your role is clear. You go out, you protect the family, you do what you have to do, and you come home, and you're with your wife and your children, and you protect your family, and you're happy. But the we go again to the balance. The truth is that barbarians were barbarians to their enemies, but they were pretty cool guys to their family. Do you understand what I mean?
It's all yes, I agree. Yeah, right.
so to the Romans, the Germans were barbarians. The Germans and Romans were barbarians. This is a relative thing. Why were they described as barbarians? Because they had swords and they fought against their intrusion, right? So, of course, our enemies will call us barbarians. They already do, right? Because if you see interviews and say, oh, white nationalists are savage barbarians, they're evil and they love to hate, and all this kind of, you know, very childish nonsense. So we already brand as barbarians. Unfortunately, we're not that good of barbarians. We're really, really low-level barbarians. And what I'm saying is that we should be a little bit better at it. We should be more in touch with our natural side, more in touch with this barbarian side. But that does not mean that you have to go home and be a barbarian in your home. It just means that you have to, when confronted with your enemies and when confronted with this battle, you have to battle it out, and you have to be courageous and not fear death and not fear shame, and just go forward and fight it out. And that's really the gist of it.
So that the warrior is not different from the family man. I mean, the warriors are made up of all the family men, yes. You know, of the tribe or whatever. Yeah.
Yes. And actually in ancient times, the Kshatriya, for example, in India, that class, the warrior class, the Arjuna was in the story, right?
Mm-hmm.
Bhagavad Gita, he is a warrior. But the warriors in those days were also administrators. In other words, their job was not only to go with swords, because there was not fights every day. Their job was also to administer the home, and I'm talking about administer financially, right? And administer the kingdom. Their job was administrative as well. Their job was not only to, in the samurai, the same in Japan, right? And the knights, the same. The knights had their own castles. They had land that they had to manage. They didn't just go around chopping off heads. The warrior also has a lot of other duties, and the main duty is the family man duty to take care of the home, to make sure that everything's fine, that there's food on the table, that there's things ready, that their children are clothed, that when someone gets sick, they're taken care of. That is the job of a family man, and that is the job of a warrior. And we have to visualize them as together. So every man, every white man that goes out into the world to do whatever his job is, to whatever he is, he has to see it. I'm going out because I'm doing my duty as a man, and I'm doing my duty as a warrior. And when I come home, I'll take care of my family, and I'll protect them, and I'll be kind to them, because that is my job, right? This is who I am, and this is what makes our people great. And I think the more we internalize these things, the better we will become as the leadership of our people, and our leadership will grow, and eventually we can lead our people to victory without really caring to see it. But we want to participate of creating this, right?
Yes, and you know, this is all, you know, if men were really like that, women would do anything for them. I'm telling you.
Well, of course,
you
know what I mean? That's the point. Yeah,
this is what we. But this is what we have to aim at. We can't aim lower than that. You know.
Exactly. Yes. That's the point. You're right, Carolyn. That's the point. The point is that if we aim low, we will get low results. We always have to aim high. We cannot aim average. We cannot aim low. We aim high. Now, will we come short sometimes? Yes, we will. But we have to still say we have to get there. We have to set high goals. We cannot set average goals so fulfill them, right? Oh, I'm going to read today. I'm going to read from Mein Kampf 5 pages, and that's my goal. Then, of course, you're going to make that goal, but it's a really crappy goal. You should set yourself a really high goal, and that high goal should be, I'm going to read 2 chapters today. The point is, in life, you have to set yourself high standards for yourself, high standards for those around you, and it's nothing bad with that. And then you have to set high goals for yourself and for your movement and for your objectives, and then you have to fight for them. And you have to keep at it over and over and over and over again, and we will win, but we have to see the world that way.
Well, you know, you're big at giving a lot of reading lists, and you really can do that. What are some of the books that you think every white nationalist should absolutely have read already, and if they haven't, they should go and read them? Just maybe three or so.
This will get complicated, but let me see. One would be The False Assumptions of Democracy by Anthony Ludovici. Now, this book you can find for free online. It's called The False Assumptions of Democracy by Anthony Ludovici. That book is crucial because
like him. I've read some of his stuff.
Yeah, he's awesome. And he goes into a lot of these things, right? Because he goes into patriarchy too, in a way. But specifically, he goes into this issue of democracy. And I think it's spectacular reading because if you read that book and you really consume it, if you really just take it down, right, then that book will really give you a true perspective on how to argue and how to understand all these false assumptions of liberalism and egalitarianism, et cetera. Another book that I love personally is Might is Right by Ragnar Redbeard. You probably read it. I love that book.
I have not, no.
You haven't? No, it's a spectacular book.
I should.
Might is Right is not that long. It's a very intense book. Now, I know a lot of Christians are not going to agree with that book because that book specifically attacks a lot of the values that mainstream Christians value. Of course, CIs don't, because CIs know that the values that he's criticizing, which are Judeo-Christian values, are wrong. So CIs shouldn't have a problem with it. But maybe like a Catholic would have a problem with it. But I think it's not a bad thing for him to read it anyway, because the book in particular addresses the issues of weakness, the issues of might as a value, etc. So a spectacular book. Another book that I would say is a great book. It's a kind of old book. It's from 1680, but it's by a man named Robert Filmer. He wrote a book called Patriarcha, or The Natural Power of Kings. Now, I'm just mentioning this book in the context because we were talking about this, so I just thought, okay, let's just mention that book. But that book, it's a very short book. You can probably also find it because, I mean, it's from 1680, so it's pretty old, so you'll find it for free. But that book is from a Christian perspective. Because we're talking about 1680, and he talks he combines biblical with logic, right? The natural law. But that book is awesome because it analyzes the issue of patriarchy from the perspective of the father, and how the role of the father is the core value of almost all government of Western values of government. So it's really good to get like a perspective on government. And of course, he's talking about monarchy. But remember, again, monarchy is the name of any government that is run by one person. So monarchy does not necessarily imply how succession occurs. It just specifically addresses how power is wielded. How succession occurs is a separate issue. You can have succession by family line. You can have succession by different ways, right? But succession is independent of monarchy. Monarchy just means mono, right? Single government. Mm-hmm. Single rule. So those would be like three great books that I think are great. I have a lot of other books, but personal books, but that would be the ones that are contextually relevant to what we're talking about today.
Okay, thank you. Now, you in your last paragraph of this particular article, weakness article, you say our survival is in our grasp, and there is simply no other reality than the will to power. You know, I think the will to power is something that I don't know why some people understand that and some people don't. Maybe what can you say about that?
Well, I mean, will to power, a lot of people, when they hear will to power, they think of Friedrich Nietzsche, right? Because he specifically talked about the will to power. But the will to power is just a very general term. The will to power is that in National Socialism was obsessed with this concept too. So those that don't like Nietzsche, but they can still like National Socialism, therefore it would apply to them anyway. But the will to power is the basic desire of every creature, because survival, right? Survival is our basic desire, but the will to power, the desire for power, is an extension of the desire to survive, because it's the extension to establish yourself in sufficient enough power to be able to survive easier, and to also to extend that power to your children. In other words, to extend yourself through time, right? The idea of progeny, of future generations. So the will to power, this desire to fight, to survive, and to impose yourself in history, right? And I mean yourself and your people. This desire is basic. is the basic need of almost all creatures, but specifically of our people and of individuals as well. So if you lose this will to power, then you lose everything. You're basically a dead man walking around, but you're basically dead. And countries that lose that will to power, they're also walking around dead, basically. In the United States, in my opinion, it's kind of like a dead man in a wheelchair, and he has IVs and everything. Yeah. He's just walking around, and they're just pushing him right as a vegetable. Because the people that built this country are dead.
All right. We have only 30 seconds left, and now less than that. So, I think will to power is seen by so many people as something, oh, that's too harsh, that's too bad, that's dominating, and we really need to understand that we need to embrace this and see it as good. Severus, I want to thank you so much for being on tonight. I think it was just an excellent program, and we'll have it up for download in a short time, and I know that I'll be asking you to come back again. So,
thank you. Thank you for having me, Carolyn. Appreciate it.
Thank you. Great. Thank you. Yes, it was. All right. Good night, listeners.
Thanks for listening, and be sure to visit Carolyn's website at carolynyager.com.